Morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Patrick Knight. I'm from the Milwaukee law firm of Gimbel, Riley, Guerin & Brown, and I represent David Sismakiewicz, who is an IRS officer for in excess of 20 years, received forwarded emails from his former supervisor that ultimately led to his suspension, then being charged and convicted of a violation of the Federal Wiretap Act. At the outset, what is not in dispute is that this was probably the most common most heavily utilized email program, Microsoft Outlook 2003, the application of which I'm sure the Court is well aware of, but there is no dispute in the evidence received at trial that in the function available in Outlook of rules, where you can click on a rule and create one that in essence says that after a message is received at the at a particular laptop.
So before we get into your description of Outlook, I wonder why the argument you're making makes any difference. Your argument, as I understand it, is that your client violated the Stored Communications Act rather than the Wiretap Act.
Well,
and if I understand that correctly, I can't see why that matters. The maximum penalty for a Wiretap Act conviction is 5 years. Maximum penalty for a Stored Communications Act conviction is 1 year, and your client got no years. Your client was sentenced to probation.
That is correct.
So what's the difference? It doesn't look like there's any practical point in saying, gee, the conviction should have been under the Stored Communications Act rather than the Wiretap Act. In other words, your argument seems to be that there was a misnomer in the indictment. They cited the wrong statute rather than that your client is innocent of any crime.
Your Honor, one, on issue number three that we raise, obviously, with regard to whether there's any evidence to suggest that he, in fact, he went in and created a rule or ever had the opportunity or whether. But the fact of the matter is the opportunity to defend against that was lost. He's faced with a wiretap, which has different elements, and the opportunity to then defend it. The Stored Communications Act is not a lesser-included offense that that he can defend against simultaneously. So while the jury found against us on the issue of, I mean, I presume that they concluded, contrary to the evidence that we put forward, that they drew the inference that he had the opportunity or the ability somehow to go in and create this rule on another computer.
The jury obviously found all of those things.
That's
right. And that's what sets up my question. If the jury found all of those things, and your defense is that this was not an interception because of the timing, that means that it was a violation of the Stored Communications Act. And that's what gives rise to my question.
Then we should have had the opportunity to defend on the...
You didn't have any defense. Your defense was my client violated the Stored Communications Act.
That is with regard to the proof of issues that were raised with regard to 1 and 2, Your Honor. We are submitting that it is the inappropriate charge to bring, that there is not a basis. It is a, with regard to initially, that it is a stored communication and that it does not require a device. It does not involve a device as utilized in this instance. But that is correct. With regard to those two issues, we're saying that's a failure.
Let's then go back to you were beginning to describe Outlook. Now, let me tell you what I understand the prosecutor to be claiming that the record supports. Maybe this is wrong, but what I understand the prosecutor to be saying about the technical process is that the email does not arrive on a client computer and then get forwarded from the client computer. The email arrives at a central server, in this case in Kansas City, and the central server then makes two copies and sends them simultaneously, one to the original intended recipient and one was sent to your client. And that sure looks like an interception rather than a store and forward behavior. Now, is that description of what happens, what the logic sequence is, right or wrong?
That is incorrect. And that is incorrect because of the manner in which Outlook operates and the way in which rules are created. I have the same thing through through we have an exchange server in my office, and unfortunately, having utilized rules over the years, I still get undeliverable messages back for paralegals who left my employment several years ago. But in this instance, the rule is created on the individual computer.
That's where the rule is created. You're not addressing my question.
The rule is
created on the individual computer. My understanding about what the prosecutor says the evidence shows, the rule is created on the individual computer, but everybody's account is administered at a central server. So the rule is created on the client computer and sent to the server. And the server then decides who gets copies of any incoming email. There's a very familiar approach. That's what happens with Google Mail, for example, or Yahoo, or Apple's Mobile Me service. You create a rule on your client computer, it's sent to the server, and the server then decides who gets copies of every message. Now, the prosecutor's claim is that that's how Outlook works, too. And I want to know whether, in your view, that's what the evidence supports, or you're contending that the evidence doesn't support that view.
No, the evidence doesn't support that view because the rule is ineffective unless the operative computer is online. In other words, the rule that's created on a particular one, if it's offline, there is no, in effect, operative. It is interconnected when you are online. That's the only time that you can receive email in any fashion.
No, counsel, maybe I'm just not being clear. The client computer has to be alive and connected to the Internet to receive email. If the prosecutor is correct, suppose I have an Outlook account. I don't, but suppose I do. And Judge Posner sends me an email. It will go to some, if the prosecutor is right about how Outlook works, it will go to some central server. Now, suppose that email, somebody has set up my account to forward the email to Judge Kaney.
Mm-hmm.
If my computer is offline, I won't get the email until I go back online. But if Judge Kaney's computer is online, he will get the email before I do, because he gets it straight from the central server.
If that were the case, there would be some evidence somewhere of an email being received during the period of time that Ms. Infusino's computer was offline. And there isn't in this case.
You don't prove how an email server works by looking at the timestamps on the messages that your client chose to retain. He obviously threw a lot out. You prove how it works by getting a software engineer on the stand or looking at its manual, which describes how it works. Now, I assume that was done. Maybe it wasn't.
Wasn't in this in terms of bringing in a software engineer. The testimony with regard to it, though, is the rule that
was
is created.
Was the manual for the Outlook server introduced into evidence?
No, it was not.
And how does anybody know how the Outlook server works if there was no technical expert and no documentation?
Under the law, there's not a distinction between Ms. Infusino's computer and the server. That they are one and the same in terms of receipts.
Don't answer my question with irrelevancies. I'm trying to figure out how the server works. And then you can make your legal argument, right? Now, my question, I will obviously have to ask the question to Ms. O'Neill. How does one know how the server works? How do you support your claim about how it works? How did the government support its claim about how it works? If there was no technical expert and no documentation in the record, is this just intuition about how Outlook works?
No. The evidence as received in it is that is what the court has seen in the transcript, that the rule is created. The argument that...
No. You're now telling me what you think is happening. I'm asking about the evidence. Was there a technical expert?
Not only with regard to an examination of the emails that were retrieved.
Was there any documentation?
What was the evidence about how Outlook operates?
The evidence is how Outlook operates is that the rule that was found on this...
What is the evidence?
Some person testified. Who was that person? Right? Tell us what the evidence was, not your interpretation of it.
The government's expert in this matter, William Taylor, testified that the emails in question that he examined Mr. Cismakiewicz's, the emails received by him, He testified on three separate occasions that those were forwarded from Ms. Infusino's computer. Ms. Memo testified in her review of the rule involved that those were forwarded from there.
But who testified about the Kansas City exchange server?
Mr. Taylor also testified with regard.
You say he's an expert. He's a what?
He was offered as the government's forensic expert.
He's an engineer?
A forensic expert? But there's no reason why a forensic expert would know how a particular email server works.
No, his was the examination of the data on the computers.
Is he an engineer?
No, not that not to my knowledge.
What is he?
I would defer to the government in that regard. He was the investigative agent.
Pardon?
He was the investigative agent who examined.
But he's just FBI or Treasury or something?
That would be correct.
The FBI has a lot of engineers and chemists and other people on its staff. Presumably this man had some background that made him an expert. What was that background?
Background was a forensic examination of computers to recover data.
That's what he began to do after he acquired his background. All right. I will ask Ms. O'Neill where her description comes from. You know, the two parties' briefs describe what Outlook does in a totally different way, and normally this is something on which the record bears out one view and not the other. We do need to figure out which and why.
Your Honor, then moving on to the issues before, the issues of the stored communication, the operation of the rule is by nature that it is only applied after it's received. I would submit under the line of cases involved that receipt is complete when it is with either her computer or her account through
Suppose
the exchange server.
You seem to think it's critical that that everything be moving when the interception occurs. Let me ask you this question. Suppose I had a device, and with my device, I tap into your voicemail. So a message comes in, you don't answer the phone, goes into your voicemail. I then steal it. Then later, you come home and you check your voicemail. And at that point, the communication between the caller and you is complete. But there's been this interim when it was just sitting in voicemail, and that's when I stole it. Now, would that be an interception?
No, it would not.
Sounds like an interception. That is, the communication took a long time to reach the intended recipient. And in the course of that long period, which included a period where where the electrons weren't moving, I stole it. Why isn't that an interception?
For the same reason that picking up a phone call that's intended to someone else is an interception. When it is received, when the message is received, the transmission is complete. I do not believe under the line
of cases.
You think
it makes a difference where the voicemail is stored? Right? Suppose you have an account with AT&T that all the voicemail is on AT&T's computers and not on your home tape recorder. Your argument, as I understand it, is that it's an interception if the voicemail is arriving straight from AT&T because it's never got to your home before. But it's not an interception if it's stored on a digital recorder at your home.
Is
that your argument?
I believe under the circumstances that there, once it is accessible, whether it is, whether you make contact with it or not, or whether it actually is accessed, that at that point the transmission is complete, that it is a stored communication.
Is it your position that it matters whether the voicemail is originally stored on AT&T's computer and comes to you for the very first time when you dial up AT&T and ask for it, or instead whether it was transmitted to your home setup and recorded at home? I thought your brief said that was the difference, but now it sounds like maybe you're not saying that's the difference.
Perhaps I'm not following the question accurately, but with regard...
The question I asked about Outlook, actually.
With regard to access, if we're talking about the use of a device that accesses at a location prior to the ability to access the information, then I think that you have a situation in which you can have an interception. But translating that to what we're dealing with now, by its very nature and by the nature of the rule, an email communication cannot be forwarded to the defendant unless it is received either at the laptop or in the that individual's account at the exchange server. So by its very nature, it's not copied and forwarded or anything of that nature until that receipt takes place. And that receipt, under a long line of cases, establishes it to be a stored communication.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Knight. Ms. O'Neill.
Yes, Your Honor.
I think you can tell what the first question is.
If I can. Your Honor, may it please the Court. All pretrial motions in this case had to do with Mr. Simiskevich's creation, or the government's, in the defendant's view, inability to prove the creation of this rule. It wasn't until the Rule 29 motion when this issue of contemporaneous versus simultaneous first came up. So I absolutely agree that the record is not as developed as it should have been. Special Agent William Taylor from the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration was the government's computer forensics expert in this case. At page 66 of the transcript, he describes his credentials, which include running one of four labs in the United States for TIGTA, as it's commonly known, for the purpose of computer forensics.
Running a lab is irrelevant. The head of NASA doesn't necessarily have the ability to describe how any particular part of the space shuttle works. The head of NASA's job is to be able to hire and fire people who can do that. So what, to go back to Judge Posner's question, what actual credentials does this man have other than being a personnel manager?
He is a computer forensic analyst and has been trained in computer forensic analysis, including using Forensic Toolkit, which is the analysis tool that was used in his case.
You're both saying the same thing, and what that says to me is that he has no credentials, no expertise whatsoever in narrating how Outlook works. Right? A computer forensic analyst is very good at figuring out what's actually on a hard disk, even if its data directory, even if the directory that tells you where particular files are located, has been scrambled. That's what a computer forensic analyst does. Knowing the internal logic of a particular software package is not in his portfolio. So what is the basis of the assertion in your brief that the way Outlook works is that the forwarding rule is applied at the server level rather than the client level?
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree, but I believe that Ms. Agent Taylor's testimony as a whole shows a very good working knowledge of the use of Outlook. He describes the difference between a PST and an OST. He talks about specific exhibits that he recovered from the hard drive in this case,
Look,
including...
Could you actually address my question? You cannot, by recovering things from somebody's hard drive, figure out how the logic of a central email server works. The two parties' briefs in this case offer completely different descriptions about how Outlook's server works. Mr. Knight could not describe the basis for his description. I would really appreciate it if you could describe the basis of your description.
Yes, Your Honor. Page 2 of Exhibit 57, which relates to Count 3, has the Outlook header information, which is Outlook's direction to the server and to the individual email accounts, including the IP addresses. And as Agent Taylor testified, this email was received by David Simiskevich, the defendant. Its delivery time, its creation time, and its submit time were all exactly the same. Agent Taylor testified that based on his knowledge and his experience of Outlook, that means that this email was created by the original sender, submitted to the Outlook server in Kansas City, and delivered to David Simiskevich, the defendant, all at the exact same second. That is absolutely the definition of contemporaneous within...
You're Maybe I am completely unclear, but this answer is not addressing my question. If the client is online, there will be a contemporaneous delivery to the person marked as getting a forwarded copy, whether the decision is made at the server level or the client level. Now, the parties can make legal arguments about the consequences of the decision being made at the client level rather than the server level. But the fact that it's contemporaneous won't tell you whether the decision is being made at the client level or the server level. It just won't.
Your Honor, the testimony from both Special Agent Taylor as well as Mr. Teets, who is an MITS or an IT specialist for the IRS, both addressed the issue and indicated that rules reside on the exchange server and are executed at the exchange
and
server.
What is the basis for that belief?
Their experience with computer systems, including in particular the IRS computer system.
Do you think it makes a legal difference whether whether the defendant, suppose his theory is the defendant always received the forwarded message after it had been sent to the Ms. Infusio's computer. Isn't that his notion? Well, does that make a legal difference?
No, Your Honor, I do not believe
that.
Can it
still be an interception? I don't understand why that should make a difference.
Your Honor,
I understand there's a Stored Communications Act, but even if there's a sense in which it was sitting on Ms. Infusio's unopened computer before the defendant read it, I don't know why it's not still a matter of his interception. I don't.
Your Honor, I absolutely agree. The defendant tries to create.
I mean, it's like the voicemail thing, or I shouldn't really use voicemail. It's voicemail, I think, means that that it's the telephone company that's storing it. But think of the old-fashioned, recorder, telephone recorder. So it seems to me it's still an interception if you take that, if you eavesdrop on someone's on the recorder that's storing his telephone messages, even if it's already arrived at the person's telephone, the intended recipient's telephone. It's gotten there. That's why it's being stored. Now you eavesdrop on it. Couldn't that be interception, or is that blocked by cases which say that is the interception has to be before the intended recipient's machine receives the communications?
Your Honor, I absolutely agree that is an interception. The issue then is whether it's contemporaneous with its transmission, because obviously the Wiretap Act requires contemporaneous, not simultaneous, but contemporaneous interception. And it's not entirely clear post-Patriot Act whether a voicemail
store. Well, this definition of intercept doesn't say contemporaneous. Is that some gloss somewhere else? Or
Your Honor, that is
a statute? Or
that is a line of cases that began with Steve Jackson Games, continued through Canope, was decidedly overruled by the First Circuit sitting en banc in Councilman, but then once again picked up and extended by the Central District of California in the Bunnell case.
And why do we care what the Central District of California did?
I think we shouldn't care, and the government submits that it was decided incorrectly, and that the better reasoning is by the First Circuit in Councilman, which is a very similar situation with a split at the server, just like in this case, of these emails to two recipients, one, the intended recipient, and two, the unintended recipient. In Councilman, it was the owner of the email server. In this case, it was Mr. Simoskevich.
Did the government attempt to establish a motive for the defendant in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. That evidence was severely limited by the district court, but one of the emails that was submitted as an exhibit talks about performance problems the defendant was having at work at about the same time that these first emails were forwarded. It had to do with Mr. Simiskevich's conviction for a drunk driving offense. And by virtue of the fact that Mr. Simiskevich is a revenue officer for the IRS, he is required to go out and visit clients, people that he is trying to collect from. And obviously, an individual with a drunk driving conviction does not have a driver's license and therefore is severely impeded in his ability to go out and visit clients. And this email letter that is in the exhibits talks about how he has not been visiting clients and he has not been performing one of the essential functions of his job. And that was the government's motive that, as noted, was limited by the trial court but was put into evidence by virtue of that email.
He deleted, apparently, a lot of these, most of the messages he received. Aren't there techniques for recovering deleted messages from a computer?
Yes, Your Honor, there are various techniques. One was used in this case, and that was by finding them on what's known as the OST, which is the offline email folder. And what happened in this case is that Mr. Simiskevich deleted them while online, but when he did not take the computer back offline to sync it back up, and that's why they were still able to be recovered by Special Agent
but
Taylor.
But they weren't all recovered.
No, absolutely not.
Why couldn't they all be recovered?
Your Honor, it has to do with how a computer overwrites data. What happens when
it was full, you mean?
When a file is deleted, what actually happens is that the first letter of the file is taken off, and then the computer sees that as free space, and then
right, I understand. So, yeah.
The first letter of the file?
Yes.
Technically, what you mean is that the pointer in the disk directory is deleted.
That's
so that the disk directory, which is what tells the operating system which space is free, has marked space as free, and then it can be overwritten by something else.
Yes, Your Honor, that is a much more accurate definition. I view it practically as the question mark.
You're speaking to me rather than Judge Easterbrook or Judge Post.
But for me, when I see the files, it begins with a question mark, which is an indicator to the computer that it is free space, or, as Judge Easterbrook noted.
I thought that happened rarely with modern computers, which have such vast capacity.
Your Honor, it very much depends on, obviously, the computer and how it chooses to overwrite data. We certainly did not get into this in this record in terms of how much was overwritten.
It also depends on file optimization routines. The most modern computers automatically optimize files, which means writing over used space.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Makes the Defense Department happy. It's not clear it makes forensic examiners happy.
It certainly does not, and frequently makes prosecutors unhappy as well. I see that my time is nearing its end. The government views this as a contemporaneous, if not simultaneous, interception case, whether it contemporaneously intercepted at Ms. Infozino's PST on the Kansas City server or as soon as it hit the server.
Has there been any litigation about the application of the Wiretap Act to packet-switched voice technology, voice over IP technology, which is essentially where the phone business is going? It's where fourth-generation cell phones will be. Because if I understand the defendant's argument correctly, the Wiretap Act would not cover any packet-switch technology, not just email, but it wouldn't cover packet switch voicemail. So I wonder whether there's been any litigation about packet switch voicemail.
To my knowledge, Your Honor, because it is such a new technology and just beginning, there has not been litigation. It was very recently that the government was even able to intercept.
It's not particularly new technology. It's how Skype and Vonage work today, and they've been around for some years. But it's not a big share of the market yet, but it's certainly growing.
That is correct, and it's finally within the last several years that the government has actually been able, the FCC has actually been able to use CALEA to bring Vonage, if not Skype, because that's an overseas company, into CALEA and require Title III permitting the government to intercept. And so to my knowledge, there has not been litigation on private parties doing this, certainly not, and not anything in the Title III realm in terms of law enforcement interception. If there are no other further questions, I will surrender the remainder of my time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.